Well, good morning. Welcome again to Broadlands. My name is Greg Walker. I'm filling in for Wallace, who's out of town this week. So I'm going to be talking today on Hebrews 12:1. It says, "Let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us." Let me just open us in a word of prayer. Lord Jesus, I do thank you for your word. I thank you for the encouragement. And Lord, just as that song we sang says, you are the God who stands with wide open arms, just ready to accept us. And Lord, just your heart of compassion and love for us is overwhelming. Father, I pray that as I speak this morning, just sharing the things that you've been stirring in my heart, that you would, as you say in your word, that your word goes out and it doesn't return to you void. I pray, Lord, that it just settles on the hearts of your people and you speak what you're doing in their lives, Lord, just to encourage us to follow hard after you. Again, just I thank you for this time. I pray that I would speak nothing but words from you and just give you this time. In Jesus' name, amen. So Wallace asked me a few weeks ago if I could fill in for him this week. And just as I spend time with the Word and with God, I kind of take notes of just things that he's showing me. And there have been a couple of things that the Lord was stirring on my heart before Wallace asked me. And when he asked me, I was like, okay, yeah, sure, you know, I'll be happy to. And so I started thinking, okay, well, of these two things, let me kind of, you know, the Lord's been showing me a lot about compassion and then also about perseverance. And so as I was kind of wrestling through, like, what do I speak on? You know, I kind of got to the point where I was like, well, you know, I only speak like once or twice a year. And so I just figured I'd give both messages this morning. So I hope you guys don't have anywhere to go. But all jokes aside, I really did feel like as I was going through, the Lord kind of put both of them together, which I hope makes more sense as I get into it. But and in preparing for this message too, like I started to get excited and pumped up, and you know, I'm going to be talking about racing because that's part of my life and what I do. But it really applies to any effort that you do where there's a performance involved. And you know, I mean, my daughter is big into drama and that's her thing, and you know, I know Reese is in marching band, and you know, I mean, we all have things that we have a performance for. And for me, you know, preparing for a race, there gets this like nervous excitement where you're getting amped up and you're excited, and you know, the day of, it's, you know, I don't have any problem getting out of bed, and you go to the line and it, you know, you just can't wait to get started. And there's an element of like, I have that just with what God's been showing me. Like, despite racing being hard, I'm excited. And this message has really been brewing over the last several years. For those of you that know me, you know I ride my bike a lot. It's just, that's what I do. It was like in my 30s, I started getting to the point where I realized I'm not in my 20s anymore. And you don't recover the same, and you know, you start getting soft around the middle and all over, and you know, it just, effort took more. And I kind of got to the point where I was like, I can either start exercising or I just need to sit on my couch for the rest of my life. Some people say I tend towards extremes, but you know, so I decided, okay, I'm just going to start exercising. I need to, you know, I like being active. And so, long story short, a friend sold me a bike and I started riding my bike. And when I first started, I absolutely hated it. I would get out and you just, like, my lungs are burning, my legs are burning, the seat's uncomfortable. And it was one of these, I just hated riding. And I'd be out there like, why am I doing this? And then I'd get home and I'd be like, okay, when's the next time I can go for a ride? I don't know. I'm a bit neurotic, I guess, but I eventually got to a point where things changed, and I'll get into that a little bit later, but I started racing my bike, which is a whole nother level. But when I started racing, God started showing me these parallels to the Christian life and racing and just the effort involved. And that's really what I'm going to spend, I think, the most time talking about this morning. I think God gives us these pictures in life. I mean, all Ecclesiastes and Proverbs, there's like these life pictures that teach us spiritual principles. And so, you know, whether you enjoy exercise or racing, or whether the thought of exercise makes you grab a donut and a Gatorade to recover, I hope there's something that you can grab hold of in this message to encourage you in your faith and in your walk with the Lord. But I first wanted to talk about, what is the race? You know, my personality, I don't do well with vague I need concrete, I need to be able to wrap my hands around something and really understand what I'm talking about or how something works. And there's this notion of like, you know, okay, run with perseverance this race. Well, so I started thinking about it, and you know, we really live in a performance-based society. I mean, and I don't think it's just Northern Virginia, I don't think it's just the U.S., but there is this notion in society from, you know, school to your job to everything, where it's all about what you do, what you accomplish, what you perform. You know, and like there's this show that my family and I were watching, and the family, like, they're raising their kids to be socially conscious, and every night at dinner they would sit down and say, well, what did you do to change the world today? Right? And there's very much a message in our society of that. What are you doing to change this world? And I think it's pervasive in Christianity too. Like, what are you doing for God? How many souls have you reached? How many children have you fed? You know, and I don't mean to speak anything negative about anybody and what they do, but the more I read the scriptures, the more I feel like that is just completely divorced from who God is and what he expects of us. I have a friend, we were talking, and this friend made the comment, and I know their heart, and it's, they have a great relationship with the Lord, and so this isn't about them, but it's more just about this line of thinking. But this friend made the comment, like, well, I wonder what the next big thing God has for me to do. And it just struck me, like, this is that thinking, right? And when I read the scriptures, I don't see God calling us to do anything big. I mean, he does, but at the same time, he doesn't. And Sophie and I were talking the other morning, and I was talking about Esther. And Esther is one of my absolute favorite people in the Bible. Peter and Esther are my two spiritual heroes when it comes to the scriptures. And you look at the story of Esther, and she asked me, like, you know, why is that? And you look at the story of Esther, and I know this is a four-letter word in our culture this day, but she is the perfect embodiment of submission. Right, and we're all called to submit because we're under the authority of Christ. So we all have to submit in our own way. But she embodies submission. You know, when she goes to rescue the Jews, right? Because Haman has this plot to kill all the Jews, of which she is one, and her uncle Mordecai is pushing her, like, you need to go and address the king. And so her way, you know, I mean, I can picture this playing out in a sitcom where she just storms in and is like, you need to do this and he's going to kill me. And you know, and she's just hammering him, like nagging him to get him to move. But what does Esther do? What's her big accomplishment? She invites her husband to lunch. Now, seriously, let that sink in. Like, she invites her husband to lunch, and that's her big accomplishment. That's what God uses to save the entire nation of Israel, right? And I'm sure going into this, she has the weight of saving the nation of Israel on her shoulders, right? But all she did was invite him to lunch, and God uncovered the plot and made everything, and everything turned around upside down in the course of a lunch. And I look at Moses too, right? And Moses is a great example because Moses led the people out of Egypt. He saved the Israelites from slavery under Egypt, right? But what did God really tell Moses to do? He said, go to Pharaoh and tell him, let my people go. And you read the story, and God literally walks Moses through every step of what he's supposed to do. I want you to go to Pharaoh. I want you to tell him, let my people go. He's not going to listen to you. Throw your stick on the ground. It'll turn into a snake. Pick it up. You know, and it literally tells him every step of the way. The way my mind works and how our society works is God says, hey, go rescue my people Israel. Okay, God, got it. I'll check back in when I'm done. Right? I'll escalate it if I run into any problems, but I got it. And go back to Wallace's message in the beginning of March on Romans 8, the message entitled Vacate. And if you haven't heard it, go listen to that message. Like, I'd rather you go home now and listen to that message and forget anything I'm saying. Because it, in all honesty, that is so fundamental to our walk with the Lord and doing anything. And God used that message powerfully in my life to really make some connections that I've been struggling with for 30 years of just not understanding how God works. And so my point here, this race, it really boils down to two fundamental things. God says in John 6:29, believe in the one I sent. And I can thank my wife for pointing this out to me. Like, that's our work as a Christian. Believe in the one he has sent. And, you know, I'm simple enough to be like, okay, yeah, I believe. Okay, I got that done. I can sit down and watch TV now, right? But believing God, that's a difficult job. I don't know about you, but most of the times God's spoken something into my life, it is counter to everything I think and believe. Just like Moses, Lord, send somebody else. I tried. I failed. You got to figure out another way to do this. And then the other piece of it is walk by faith. And, you know, I work with the youth group, and I'm sure if they were here, they'd be rolling their eyes, because every time I talk about faith, I say, what is faith? And they should all know this by now, and I think most of you should know this because it's straight from Wallace. But faith is hearing from God and then doing what he said to do. That's it. It's not believing some big thing that I can concoct in my mind, or, you know, it's hearing from God. Read through the Bible what it says about faith. God always speaks, and then they do. And to me, that is a big deal. That is hard. But that's the race that we're called to. Believe in the one he sent, and walk by faith. So I was saying compassion is one of the things that I feel like God's been really stirring in my heart. And just by nature, I'm not a super compassionate person. It's not my gifting, but Rich is laughing. Rich and I have a very special relationship. Love you dearly. But I'm not a super compassionate person. I mean, I have my moments, but you can talk to my kids. We have this joke, like, my kids are very thankful that I'm not their teacher. I'm a really hard grader, and I have high expectations, and that goes for myself, like, first and foremost. And I tend to be pretty black and white on some things. But, and two, when I was younger and had kids, or before having kids, I processed through a lot about, you know, just different people I knew growing up and parenting styles, and I kind of came to this conclusion, and I was like, you need to be a strict parent to have a good, obedient kid. And, you know, and there's truth to that, right? I mean, kids need boundaries. They need to know right from wrong. God tells us we need to teach our kids right from wrong. But when you have strictness coupled with a lack of compassion, it's just dictatorial, right? I might have obedient kids, but I don't have their heart. And you see, the other thing too is you have rebellious kids because you don't have their heart. And thankfully, God's balanced me out with my wife, who is much more compassionate. And she's thankfully often pointing out my lack of compassion. But in thinking through this too, you know, the one thought that runs through my mind is that quintessential drill instructor. Or, you know, Rich has shared stories about playing high school football, and you have that football coach that's in the kid's face, and, you know, get out of there, you dirtbag, and, you know, get over that wall, or whatever. And there's just a hammering and a negative boot across the backside motivation. Right, and it works to an extent. It motivates people. I mean, especially, you know, with military, it's like a fight or flight, right? And hopefully you're triggering the fight and not the flight. But maybe in France it's different. I don't know, but I shouldn't have said that. in all seriousness, you want that fight, but in thinking through it, it only works to a point. That lack of compassion and that harsh negative reinforcement, as soon as there's failure, that motivation turns to demotivation, and it eats the person, because at this point you're just done. And there's negative voices that are just feeding into that failure and reinforcing that failure. And it's so opposite of how I see God work in the scriptures. I reading through Kings and Chronicles, and it's astounding, God's compassion on these evil kings, right? And going through, I started taking this compassion workshop a few months ago, and really this is kind of what started getting me thinking about compassion and thinking through Jesus and his interaction with people. There were really two responses that Jesus had to people. The first was to religious leaders and political people. And it was, I almost say anger, but I think it was more intolerance at their hypocrisy, right? He didn't have anything kind or nice to say. But everybody else that Jesus interacted with, it's just compassion, filled with compassion. And, you know, I think for me, there's this a difference between the world's compassion and God's compassion, right? The world's compassion just accepts everything, and it's just, well, whatever makes you feel good, and, you know, we see it in the schools, which is astounding to me. Like, you know, it's okay that you failed this test. We'll give you the answers, and you can retake it and do better. But God's compassion, there's understanding our failure, but urges us to sin no more. And so I don't really know how to explain it. It's like an acceptance of our failure without accepting our failure, if that makes any sense. And I just had this picture too. It's like God sees into our heart, right? He knows our heart. And I think all of us have this desire to make life work. I don't think anybody's out there just, there are a few people that don't fit this, but people are trying to make life work. And it's like God sees our brokenness and are trying to make things work and trying to make it work without him sometimes, and sees our heart. And it's like he's filling that void with his love to spur us on to go and sin no more. But anyway, there are kind of three pictures that I had of compassion that I feel like were just what the Lord was showing me. But the first one is from Psalm 37, 23 through 24. And I'll just read it, but it says, "The steps of a man are established by the Lord, and he delights in his way. When he falls, he will not be hurled headlong, because the Lord is the one who holds his hand." And I don't know, I'm big into analogies and word pictures, but I had this picture of God, or a guy walking with his little kid, holding his hand, and they're, you know, running through the woods, and the kid is just kicking rocks and, you know, running ahead and all this. And the kid trips. And if it weren't for the hand of his father holding him up, he'd just fall flat on his face, you know? And I mean, we all know the bloody and bashed in, whatever, but it's like the father just kind of picks him up, kid's feet settle back underneath and puts it down, and they just keep going. And the kid's almost unaware of what happened. Certainly not like, oh my goodness, I could have died, or, you know, I mean, whatever. But it just goes on. And I've had moments like that with the Lord where it just, his compassion overwhelms me. And it just fills you with joy and peace. And it's just, thank you, God, because it protects us. Two, compassion is healing. There are two stories in particular that I think are just astounding. The first one is in 1 Kings 17, where Elijah is with the widow during the famine. And if you don't know the story, I encourage you to read it. But Elijah's with this widow, and her son dies. And she comes to Elijah and she says, "What have you against me, O man of God? You have come to me to bring my sin to remembrance and to cause the death of my son." And I kind of glossed over that for a long time. And I heard a guy give a message, and he just made the point. He said, this woman clearly has something in her past. And we don't know what it is. God doesn't tell us, and we don't have the right to speculate. But there was something that was eating her alive. You know, and I'm sure day to day she could put it aside and she could carry on. But there was something that when that event happened, it triggered. And there's a theology there of God's going to get me. God's waiting to punish me. And here it is. You've brought my sin to remembrance. And Elijah takes the boy and he takes him up to his room and he prays and he says, "Oh Lord, my God, have you brought calamity even upon the widow with whom I sojourn by killing her son?" And he prayed, "Oh Lord, let this child's life come to him again." And the Lord listened to the voice of Elijah, and the life of the child came to him again, and he revived. And Elijah took the child, brought him down from the upper chamber into the house, and delivered him to his mother. And Elijah said, "See, your son lives." And her response, and the woman said to Elijah, "Now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth." And I mean, it doesn't talk about what went on in her heart, but I got to believe there was a healing that took place from that regret, from that sin that she's carrying. And that's God's response. And a while back, I preached on the end of John, where Jesus comes back to the disciples after he was crucified. And Peter's denied Jesus three times, right? And And even one of the passages in the Gospels, it says after denying him that Jesus turned and looked at Jesus, or turned and looked at Peter. And I mean, we all know what that failure feels like, where we've let somebody down. And Jesus' response to Peter's worst failings is he comes to Peter and he says, "Peter, do you love me?" And three times, to counter each one of the denials, "Peter, do you love me?" And it's just such a beautiful picture of redemption that Jesus met Peter in the midst of his greatest failure and just picked him up and said, "Let's go, carry on, you know, get back in the race." And the last thing I'll say about compassion is there's this passage in 1 Samuel where the Israelites went out to battle against the Philistines, and Saul, in his zeal, made this oath that, you know, we will not eat until the Lord's delivered them into our hands. And, I mean, battle back then, I'm sure you all know, would have been a serious physical endeavor. You're swinging swords, you got a shield, the armor, and no food for however, come on. And his son Jonathan didn't hear, and they came across some honey, and he took some of the honey and put it in his mouth, and it says his eyes brightened. And I think that's a picture of what compassion does too. That, I mean, the race that we're called to, it's difficult. It is not easy. But compassion is going to sustain us. It's going to give us that fuel that we need to keep going. So with that, I want to kind of transition into talking about perseverance and this race. And so forgive me talking about biking, but it's, I'm going to get a little bit into the weeds about bicycle racing, and I hope you don't glaze over and can just hang with me for a minute. But it's important to me because it helps make the connections. But I'm sure most of you, if not all of you, have at least heard of the Tour de France, which is like the greatest bike race in the world. The top level athletes, they go. And I knew practically none of this when I just knew it was a race, and I knew about it from Lance Armstrong, and that was about it. But just some quick stats. It's a race that starts out generally outside of France, and they race all through France, and they go through the Alps and then through the Pyrenees, and it ends up in Paris. But this is stats from just one of the races. It's 2,131 miles long. Okay, it's a three-week race. It's 23 days, and there's two rest days. The other 21 are full bore racing, and it's, you know, 3-4 hours a day, but it averages out to just over 100 miles a day. They climb about 70,000 feet. That's a lot. It's and some of them are like steeper than your stairs that they're climbing up these mountains, and they'll climb for like an hour at a time, and several times in a day. Most of the climbing is concentrated in, you know, sort of 4 or 5 days. And the average calories burned for a cyclist in a race is 6,000 calories. That's 2.5 to 3 times the average daily intake for a normal human being, right? A normal adult. And they're burning 6,000. You can't. Anyway, I won't get into it. But if you've never watched, you probably all have heard the word from the exercise bike, the Peloton. And the Peloton is loosely defined as the greatest concentration of riders in the race at any given time. So, you know, they all start at the start line. It's a rolling start, and they go. But throughout the race, things will spread out. And depending on whether it's a mountain stage or flat or windy, like, you'll have groups that break off. You got people that crash and are dropped or whatever. But the Peloton is, there's up to about 200 riders in the Tour de France when it starts out. It's, I can't remember, it's like 8 teams and 8 riders per team. Used to be 9, but and you watch the Peloton, and it's like an amoeba. It's this mass that just moves, and it flows through the roads, and you have, like, you'll go through these narrow road villages where it's really tight, and it'll string out, and it becomes really long, but then it'll compact back together. And it's kind of amazing to watch, because they'll go around, like, they call it traffic furniture, but, you know, like obstacles in the road, and they'll just part and come back together. All of this is important to things that I'm going to talk about, so I hope I'm not boring you too much. But so for me, there was all of this started out for me. I mentioned that when I started riding my bike, I hated it. And I got to the point where I loved it. And really, the turning point for me, ironically, was watching the Tour de France, like the first time I ever watched it. And I'm watching these guys in the mountain stages, and these are the ones where they get really strung out, and the peloton at the end of a stage is like 20 guys out of 200, right? And because you have guys that are like more of your sprinters and heavier, and they can't get over the mountains as quickly as the skinny, light climbers and all this. But I'm watching these guys that are at the front of the race, and they're racing up these mountains, and they're going up these mountains faster than I would ride on the flat, which is astounding. But, you know, and what happens is you'll have these guys, like, generally the ones who are competing for the overall, they call it the GC, the general classification, but for the overall victory. And these guys are, like, at the front, and they're marking each other, but eventually somebody will make a move, and they'll sprint off the front. I mean, they're already practically on the limit. And then they'll sprint to try and get a gap so that they can go and then the guy who's behind will try and catch up. And I've made the comment that I feel like watching bike racing is kind of like watching slow motion chess. It plays out over, you know, each stage is over 4 hours, and you'll see a guy make a move and you get excited, but it takes 20, 30 minutes, 2 hours for that play to develop. But it excites me nonetheless. But anyway, I started watching this, and it was, I started going, I can do that. I'm not saying I can compete in the Tour de France, don't get me wrong, but like, I can suffer, I can put that effort in, I can really go for it. And something flipped in my mind where I started like thinking about cycling as an opportunity to suffer, which sounds kind of stupid, and most people just like, you're dumb, whatever. But They're doing it for a purpose. They're doing it for that victory. I mean, Paul has another passage where he's talking about, you know, the runners race for that crown. And they're suffering in the mountains because they want to win. And when I started going like, okay, I can climb, it was so that I could beat other people to the top of the hill. It wasn't just because, it felt great to really just have your lungs burning and your legs burning, right? But there was a purpose behind it. But it really kind of flipped a switch for me. And I say all this because it ties into Hebrews 11. Hebrews 12:1 starts out with, since we are surrounded with such a great cloud of witnesses. And that's all referring to Hebrews 11, which is commonly called the hall of faith. But God tells these stories of people who exhibited faith, that they listened to God and they did what he said. And God did these amazing, miraculous things. And he talks about like living in the promise. And when I remember the first time reading through Hebrews 11, and it was exciting. And it drove me to be like, I want to see God work that way. So that's kind of my point with all this. Like, there's a mental switch, because the bottom line, we're in a race. God has called us to be in a race, whether you want to be in it or not. And the first race I was ever in, right over here in Sterling, it was just, it was a circuit. You just went around like 20 or 30 times. And there were certain guys that in the first three laps, they're out the back, and you're passing them, like lapping them in three laps. And we called them road furniture or moving obstacles, because they're so slow that they're just in the way. And my point with all this, like, we can just not race, right? We can just be a moving obstacle to the rest of the church. But we should be in the race, because that's what God's called us to. And so the first race I ever did, I was talking to my younger brother, because he had raced and he was kind of giving me some pointers and filling me in. And he made this comment. He said, if you're not moving up, you're moving back. And I was like, that doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know what you're talking about. You know, I'd watched bicycle racing and I talked about the peloton, and it just looks like everybody's just riding together. And, you know, and they're just kind of like you see on the trail. People are riding together. They're talking, they're doing whatever. But I got in the race for the first time, and it's a fight for position the whole entire time. I mean, people are trying to get in front of you. You're trying to maintain. And so, like, there's no static anything. And my point with all this, the other morning, Sophie and I were talking and praying and talking about our kids. And the thought went through my head, like, I'm so glad my daughters know Jesus. And it's just, like, I don't have to worry about it. And as soon as the thought went through my head, I just really felt like the Lord rebuked me. And he's like, no, you need to be concerned. You need to be vigilant. You need to be paying attention because they have a target on their back. They have an enemy that's out to take them out. And if you're not engaged, if you're not aware, they're going to be devoured. And so, you know, if you're not moving up, you're moving back. And just highlighting this point too, in one of the races that I did, again, it was a circuit, but there was a half mile long climb. And I'm going up the climb and on the limit and we go over the climb and people start passing me, but I needed to catch a breath. You know, and it's only like 5 or 10 seconds, but we crest over the hill and people start passing me and this moving up or moving back is in my mind. And so I look back behind me to see how much time I have before I have to get back on the gas, and there's nobody behind me. And I turn back around and the guy in front of me is like 10 yards in front of me, the closest guy. And there's in cycling, they have drafting. Like if you're close enough to somebody, they block the wind and you can go faster at a lower level of effort. But once that draft is gone, you're done. And I panicked and I got up and I started sprinting to try and catch on. And it kept growing bigger and bigger. And I'm out of the race. I'm done. And this, leading into my next point, the whole issue then became my mental state. Do I keep racing or do I just quit and go home? And like I said, this was a circuit race, so I could have just, the next lap around, okay, I'm done, I'm going home. And it's an amateur bike race, it doesn't matter, there's no glory in finishing. But for me, there was, again, this spiritual, don't give up, don't give in. You just push and persevere and finish the race. That's what you started, finish. You know, and again, it's just, there's so much that I feel like God is saying to me of just keep going, keep going. And so much of endurance racing is more mental than it is physical. I mean, physical, obviously, it's a huge component. Riding your bike 2,000 miles is not easy. You need to have the physical ability to do it. But so often, our mind gives out way before our body will. And we were talking the other day, Wallace mentioned that his brother-in-law, the football coach, had a quote in a book. He was quoted in a book, and the quote was, you'll pass out before you die. Yeah, which is so encouraging, you know. But it's so true. I don't know that I've really hit physical limits so much as I've hit mental limits. And so much in my relationship with the Lord, it's just me getting over that hump of, okay, I can do this. And I really feel like the biggest thing is the next thing it says in Hebrews, fix your eyes on Jesus. You know, every single one of these racers, you know, you got to have your eyes on the end game. If you don't have your eyes on the end game, it's just suffering for the sake of suffering, right? But we've all been called to a race. We've all been called to compete in this race and to run the race. And there's a verse at the end of Philippians 2, 10 and 11, I think it is. But God is talking about that Jesus was exalted to the highest place because at the name, he says, at the name of Jesus, every knee will bow. And there's a day coming where the race is going to be over. And we're going to stand before the Lord and give an account. And I don't have time to get into this. I don't think that's a shameful event. I don't. But I don't want to be at a place where I regret that I didn't persevere. I didn't press on. Because I really do feel like there's so much